Chapter 4. A Note on Health to Which Religion Can Be Hazardous. In dark ages, people are best guided by religion. As in a pitch-black night, a blind man is the best guide. He knows the roads and paths better than a man who can see. When daylight comes, however, it is foolish to use blind old men as guides. Heinrich Heine, Gedanken und Einfälle. In the fall of 2001, I was in Calcutta with the magnificent photographer Sebastião Salgado, a Brazilian genius whose studies with the camera have made vivid the lives of migrants, war victims, and those workers who toil to extract primary products from mines and quarries and forests. On this occasion, he was acting as an envoy of UNICEF and promoting his cause as a crusader, in the positive sense of that term, against the scourge of polio. Thanks to the work of inspired and enlightened scientists like Jonas Salk, it is now possible to immunize children against this ghastly malady for a negligible cost. The few cents or pennies that it takes to administer 2 drops of oral vaccine to the mouth of an infant. Advances in medicine had managed to put the fear of smallpox behind us, and it was confidently expected that another year would do the same for polio. Humanity itself had seemingly united on this proposition. In several countries, including El Salvador, warring combatants had proclaimed ceasefires in order to allow the inoculation teams to move freely. Extremely poor and backward countries had mustered the resources to get the good news to every village. No more children need be killed or made useless and miserable by this hideous disease. Back home in Washington, where that year many people were still fearfully staying indoors after the trauma of 9/11, my youngest daughter was going dauntlessly door-to-door on Halloween, piping trick-or-treat for UNICEF, and healing or saving, with every fistful of small change, children she would never meet. One had that rare sense of participating in an entirely positive enterprise. The people of Bengal, and particularly the women, were enthusiastic and inventive. I remember one committee meeting where staunch Calcutta hostesses planned without embarrassment to team up with the city's prostitutes to spread the word into the farthest corners of society. Bring your children, no questions asked, and let them swallow the 2 drops of fluid. Someone knew of an elephant a few miles out of town that might be hired to lead a publicity parade. Everything was going well. In one of the poorest cities and states of the world, there was to be a new start. And then we began to hear of a rumour. In some outlying places, Muslim diehards were spreading the story that the droplets were a plot. If you took this sinister Western medicine, you would be stricken by impotence and diarrhea, a forbidding and depressing combination. This was a problem because the drops have to be administered twice, the second time as a booster and confirmation of immunity, and because it takes only a few uninoculated people to allow the disease to survive and revive and to spread back through contact in the water supply. As with smallpox, eradication must be utter and complete. I wondered, as I left Calcutta, if West Bengal would manage to meet the deadline and declare itself polio-free by the end of the next year. That would leave only pockets of Afghanistan and one or two other inaccessible regions already devastated by religious fervour before we could say that another ancient tyranny of illness had been decisively overthrown. In 2005 I learned of one outcome. In northern Nigeria, a country that had previously checked in as provisionally polio-free, a group of Islamic religious figures issued a ruling, or fatwa, that declared the polio vaccine to be a conspiracy by the United States and, amazingly, the United Nations against the Muslim faith. The drops were designed, said these mullahs, to sterilize the true believers. Their intention and effect was genocidal. Nobody was to swallow them or administer them to infants. Within months, polio was back, and not just in northern Nigeria. Nigerian travelers and pilgrims had already taken it as far as Mecca and spread it back to several other polio-free countries, including 3 African ones, and also far away Yemen. The entire boulder would have to be rolled right back up to the top of the mountain. You may say that this is an isolated case, which would be a grimly apt way of putting it, but you would be mistaken. Would you care to see my video of the advice given by Cardinal Alfonso Lopez de Trujillo, the Vatican's president of the Pontifical Council for the Family, carefully warning his audience that all condoms are secretly made with many microscopic holes through which the AIDS virus can pass? Close your eyes and try to picture what you might say if you had the authority to inflict the greatest possible suffering in the least number of words. Consider the damage that such a dogma has caused. Presumably those holes permit the passage of other things too, which rather destroys the point of a condom in the first place. To make such a statement in Rome is wicked enough, but translate the message into the language of poor and stricken countries and see what happens. During carnival season in Brazil, the auxiliary bishop of Rio de Janeiro, Rafael Jano Cifuentes, told his congregation in a sermon that the church is against condom use. Sexual relations between a man and a woman have to be natural. I have never seen a little dog using a condom during sexual intercourse with another dog. Senior clerical figures in several other countries, Cardinal Obando y Bravo of Nicaragua, the Archbishop of Nairobi in Kenya, Cardinal Emmanuel Romala of Uganda, have all told their flocks that condoms transmit AIDS. Cardinal Wamala, indeed, has opined that women who die of AIDS, rather than employ latex protection, should be considered as martyrs, though presumably this martyrdom must take place within the confines of marriage. The Islamic authorities have been no better and sometimes worse. In 1995, the Council of Ulemas in Indonesia urged that condoms only be made available to married couples, and on prescription. In Iran, a worker found to be HIV positive can lose his job, and doctors and hospitals have the right to refuse treatment to AIDS patients. An official of Pakistan's AIDS control program told Foreign Policy magazine in 2005 that the problem was smaller in his country because of better social and Islamic values. This in a state where the law allows a woman to be sentenced to be gang-raped in order to expiate the shame of a crime committed by her brother. This is the old religious combination of repression and denial. A plague like AIDS is assumed to be unmentionable because the teachings of the Quran are enough in themselves to inhibit premarital intercourse, drug use, adultery, and prostitution. Even a very brief visit to, say, Iran, will demonstrate the opposite. It is the mullahs themselves who profit from hypocrisy by licensing temporary marriages, in which wedding certificates are available for a few hours, sometimes in specially designated houses, with a divorce declaration ready to hand at the conclusion of business. You could almost call it prostitution. The last time I was offered such a bargain, it was just outside the ugly shrine to the Ayatollah Khomeini in South Tehran. But veiled and burqa-clad women, infected by their husbands with the virus, are expected to die in silence. It is a certainty that millions of other harmless and decent people will die, very miserably and quite needlessly, all over the world, as a result of this obscurantism. The attitude of religion to medicine, like the attitude of religion to science, is always necessarily problematic and very often necessarily hostile. A modern believer can say, and even believe, that his faith is quite compatible with science and medicine, but the awkward fact will always be that both things have a tendency to break religion's monopoly, and have often been fiercely resisted for that reason. What happens to the faith healer and the shaman when any poor citizen can see the full effect of drugs and surgeries administered without ceremonies or mystifications? Roughly the same thing as happens to the rainmaker when the climatologist turns up, or to the diviner from the heavens when schoolteachers get hold of elementary telescopes. Plagues of antiquity were held to be punishment from the gods, which did much to strengthen the hold of the priesthood and much to encourage the burning of infidels and heretics who were thought, in an alternative explanation, to be spreading disease by witchcraft or else poisoning the wells. We may make allowances for the orgies of stupidity and cruelty that were indulged in before humanity had a clear concept of the germ theory of disease. Most of the miracles of the New Testament have to do with healing, which was of such great importance in a time when even minor illness was often the end. Saint Augustine himself said that he would not have believed in Christianity if it were not for the miracles. Scientific critics of religion, such as Daniel Dennett, have been generous enough to point out that apparently useless healing rituals may even have helped people get better, in that we know how important morale can be in aiding the body to fight injury and infection. But that would be an excuse only available in retrospect. By the time Dr. Jenner had discovered that a cowpox vaccine could ward off smallpox, this excuse had become void. Yet Timothy Dwight, a president of Yale University, and to this day one of America's most respected divines, was opposed to the smallpox vaccination because he regarded it as an interference with God's design. And this mentality is still heavily present, long after its pretext and justification in human ignorance has vanished. It is interesting and suggestive that the Archbishop of Rio makes his analogy with dogs. They do not trouble to roll on a condom. Who are we to quarrel with their fidelity to nature? In the recent division in the Anglican Church over homosexuality and ordination, several bishops made the fatuous point that homosexuality is unnatural because it does not occur in other species. Leave aside the fundamental absurdity of this observation. Are humans part of nature or not? Or, if they chance to be homosexual, are they created in God's image or not? Leave aside the well-attested fact that numberless kinds of birds and mammals and primates do engage in homosexual play. Who are the clerics to interpret nature? They've shown themselves quite unable to do so. The condom is quite simply a necessary but not a sufficient condition for avoiding the transmission of AIDS. All qualified authorities, including those who state that abstinence is even better, are agreed on this. Homosexuality is present in all societies, and its incidence would appear to be part of human design. We must perforce confront these facts as we find them. We now know that the bubonic plague was spread not by sin or moral backsliding, but by rats and fleas. Archbishop Lancelot Andrews, during the celebrated Black Death in London in 1665, noticed uneasily that the horror fell upon those who prayed and kept the faith, as well as upon those who did not. He came perilously close to stumbling upon a real point. As I was writing this chapter, an argument broke out in my hometown of Washington, D.C. The human papillomavirus, HPV, has long been known as a sexually transmitted infection that, at its worst, can cause cervical cancer in women. A vaccine is now available. These days, vaccines are increasingly swiftly developed, not to cure this malady, but to immunize women against it. But there are forces in the administration who oppose the adoption of this measure on the grounds that it fails to discourage premarital sex. To accept the spread of cervical cancer in the name of God is no different, morally or intellectually, from sacrificing these women on a stone altar and thanking the deity for giving us the sexual impulse and then condemning it. We do not know how many people in Africa have died or will die because of the AIDS virus, which was isolated and became treatable in a great feat of humane scientific research, very soon after it made its lethal appearance. On the other hand, we do know that having sex with a virgin, one of the more popular local cures, does not in fact prevent or banish the infection. And we also know that the use of condoms can at least contribute as a form of prophylaxis to the limitation and containment of the virus. We are not dealing, as early missionaries might have liked to believe, with witch doctors and savages who resist the boons that the missionaries bring. We are instead dealing with the Bush administration, which, in a supposedly secular republic in the 21st century, refuses to share its foreign aid budget with charities and clinics that offer advice on family planning. At least two major and established religions, with millions of adherents in Africa, believe that the cure is very much worse than the disease. They also harbor the belief that the AIDS plague is in some sense a verdict from heaven upon sexual deviance, in particular upon homosexuality. A single stroke of Occam's potent razor eviscerates this half-baked savagery. Female homosexuals not only do not contract AIDS, except if they are unlucky with a transfusion or a needle, they are also much freer of all venereal infection than even heterosexuals. Yet clerical authorities persistently refuse to be honest about even the existence of the lesbian. In doing so, they further demonstrate that religion continues to pose an urgent threat to public health. I pose a hypothetical question. As a man of some 57 years of age, I am discovered sucking the penis of a baby boy. I ask you to picture your own outrage and revulsion. Ah, but I have my explanation already. I am a moil, an appointed circumciser and foreskin remover. My authority comes from an ancient text, which commands me to take a baby boy's penis in my hand, cut around the prepuce, and complete the action by taking his penis in my mouth, sucking off the foreskin, and spitting out the amputated flap, along with a mouthful of blood and saliva. This practice has been abandoned by most Jews, either because of its unhygienic nature or its disturbing associations, but it still persists among the sort of Hasidic fundamentalists who hope for the Second Temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. To them, the primitive rite of the Periah Mestitza is part of the original and unbreakable covenant with God. In New York City, in the year 2005, the ritual, as performed by a 57-year-old moil, was found to have given genital herpes to several small boys, and to have caused the deaths of at least two of them. In normal circumstances, the disclosure would have led the Public Health Department to forbid the practice, and the mayor to denounce it. But in the capital of the modern world, in the first decade of the 21st century, such was not the case. Instead, Mayor Bloomberg overrode the reports by distinguished Jewish physicians who had warned of the danger of the custom and told his healthcare bureaucracy to postpone any verdict. The crucial thing, he said, was to be sure that the free exercise of religion was not being infringed. In a public debate with Peter Steinfels, the liberal Catholic religion editor of the New York Times, I was told the same thing. It happened to be election year in New York for the mayor, which often explains a lot. But this pattern recurs in other denominations and other states and cities, as well as in other countries. Across a wide swath of animist and Muslim Africa, young girls are subjected to the hell of circumcision and infibulation, which involves the slicing off of the labia and the clitoris, often with a sharp stone, and then the stitching up of the vaginal opening with strong twine, not to be removed until it is broken by male force on the bridal night. Compassion and biology allow for a small aperture to be left, meanwhile, for the passage of menstrual blood. The resulting stench, pain, humiliation, and misery exceed anything that can be easily imagined, and inevitably result in infection, sterility, shame, and the death of many women and babies in childbirth. No society would tolerate such an insult to its womanhood, and therefore to its survival, if the foul practice was not holy and sanctified. But then no New Yorker would permit atrocities against infants, if not for the same consideration. Parents, professing to believe the nonsensical claims of Christian Science, have been accused, but not always convicted, of denying urgent medical care to their offspring. Parents who imagine themselves to be Jehovah's Witnesses have refused permission for their children to receive blood transfusions. Parents who imagine that a man named Joseph Smith was led to a set of buried golden tablets have married their underage Mormon daughters to favored uncles and brothers-in-law, who sometimes have older wives already. The Shia fundamentalists in Iran lowered the age of consent to 9, perhaps in admiring emulation of the age of the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad. Hindu child brides in India are flogged and sometimes burned alive if the pathetic dowry they bring is judged to be too small. The Vatican and its vast network of dioceses has in the past decade alone been forced to admit complicity in a huge racket of child rape and child torture, mainly but by no means exclusively homosexual, in which known pederasts and sadists were shielded from the law and reassigned to parishes where the pickings of the innocent and the defenceless were often richer. In Ireland alone, once an unquestioning disciple of Holy Mother Church, it is now estimated that the unmolested children of religious schools were very probably the minority. Now, religion professes a special role in the protection and instruction of children. Woe to him, says the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, who harms a child. The New Testament has Jesus informing us that one so guilty would be better off at the bottom of the sea and with a millstone around his neck at that. But both in theory and in practice, religion uses the innocent and the defenseless for the purposes of experiment. By all means, let an observant Jewish adult male have his raw-cut penis placed in the mouth of a rabbi. That would be legal, at least in New York. By all means, let grown women who distrust their clitoris or their labia have them sawn away by some other wretched adult female. By all means, let Abraham offer to commit suicide to prove his devotion to the Lord or his belief in the voices he was hearing in his head. By all means, let devout parents deny themselves the succor of medicine when in acute pain and distress. By all means, for all I care, let a priest sworn to celibacy be a promiscuous homosexual. By all means, let a congregation that believes in whipping out the devil choose a new grown-up sinner each week and lash him until he or she bleeds. By all means, let anyone who believes in creationism instruct his fellows during lunch breaks. But the conscription of the unprotected child for these purposes is something that even the most dedicated secularist can safely describe as a sin. I do not set myself up as a moral exemplar and would be swiftly knocked down if I did. But if I was suspected of raping a child, or torturing a child, or infecting a child with venereal disease, or selling a child into sexual or any other kind of slavery, I might consider committing suicide whether I was guilty or not. If I had actually committed the offence, I would welcome death in any form that it might take. This revulsion is innate in any healthy person and does not need to be taught. Since religion has proved itself uniquely delinquent on the one subject where moral and ethical authority might be counted as universal and absolute, I think we are entitled to at least three provisional conclusions. The first is that religion and the churches are manufactured, and that this salient fact is too obvious to ignore. The second is that ethics and morality are quite independent of faith and cannot be derived from it. The third is that religion is, because it claims a special divine exemption for its practices and beliefs, not just amoral, but immoral. The ignorant psychopath or brute who mistreats his children must be punished, but can be understood. Those who claim a heavenly warrant for the cruelty have been tainted by evil, and also constitute far more of a danger. In the city of Jerusalem, there is a special ward in the mental hospital for those who represent a special danger to themselves and others. These deluded patients are the sufferers from the Jerusalem syndrome. Police and security officers are trained to recognize them, though their mania is often concealed behind a mask of deceptively beatific calm. They have come to the holy city in order to announce themselves as the Messiah or Redeemer, or to proclaim the end of days. The connection between religious faith and mental disorder is, from the viewpoint of the tolerant and the multicultural, both very obvious and highly unmentionable. If someone murders his children and then says that God ordered him to do it, we might find him not guilty by reason of insanity, but he would be incarcerated nonetheless. If someone lives in a cave, claims to be seeing visions and experiencing prophetic dreams, we may leave him alone until he turns out to be planning, in a non-phantasmal way, the joy of suicide bombing. If someone announces himself to be God's anointed and begins stockpiling Kool-Aid and weapons and helping himself to the wives and daughters of his acolytes, we raise a bit more than a skeptical eyebrow. But if these things can be preached under the protection of an established religion, we are expected to take them at face value. All three monotheisms, just to take the most salient example, praise Abraham for being willing to hear voices, and then to take his son Isaac for a long and rather mad and gloomy walk. And then the caprice, by which his murderous hand is finally stayed, is written down as divine mercy. The relationship between physical health and mental health is now well understood to have a strong connection to the sexual function or dysfunction. Can it be a coincidence, then, that all religions claim the right to legislate in matters of sex? The principal way in which believers inflict pain on themselves, on each other, and on non-believers has always been their claim to monopoly in this sphere. Most religions, with the exception of the few cults that actually permit or encourage it, do not have to bother much with enforcing the taboo on incest. Like murder and theft, this is usually found to be abhorrent to humans without any further explanation. But merely to survey the history of sexual dread and proscription, as codified by religion, is to be met with a very disturbing connection between extreme prurience and extreme repression. Almost every sexual impulse has been made the occasion for prohibition, guilt, and shame. Manual sex, oral sex, anal sex, non-missionary position sex, to name it is to discover a fearsome ban upon it. Even in modern and hedonistic America, several states legally define sodomy as that which is not directed at face-to-face heterosexual procreation. This raises gigantic objections to the argument from design, whether we choose to call that design intelligent or not. Clearly, the human species is designed to experiment with sex. No less clearly, this fact is well known to the priesthoods. When Dr. Samuel Johnson had completed the first real dictionary of the English language, he was visited by a delegation of respectable old ladies who wished to congratulate him for not including any indecent words. His response, which was that he was interested to see that the ladies had been looking them up, contains almost all that needs to be said on this point. Orthodox Jews conduct congress by means of a hole in the sheet, and subject their women to ritual baths to cleanse the stain of menstruation. Muslims subject adulterers to public lashings with a whip. Christians used to lick their lips while examining women for signs of witchcraft. I need not go on in this vein. Any reader of this book will know of a vivid example, or will simply guess my meaning. A consistent proof that religion is man-made and anthropomorphic can also be found in the fact that it is usually man-made in the sense of masculine as well. The holy book in the longest continuous use, the Talmud, commands the observant one to thank his maker every day that he was not born a woman. This raises again the insistent question, who but a slave thanks his master for what his master has decided to do without bothering to consult him? The Old Testament, as Christians condescendingly call it, has woman cloned from man for his use and comfort. The New Testament has St. Paul expressing with fear and contempt for the female. Throughout all religious texts, there is a primitive fear that half the human race is simultaneously defiled and unclean, and yet is also a temptation to sin that it is impossible to resist. Perhaps this explains the hysterical cult of virginity and of a virgin, and the dread of the female form and of female reproductive functions. And there may be someone who can explain the sexual and other cruelties of the religious without any reference to the obsession with celibacy, but that someone will not be me. I simply laugh when I read the Quran with its endless prohibitions on sex and its corrupt promise of infinite debauchery in the life to come. It's like seeing through the let's pretend of a child, but without the indulgence that comes from watching the innocent at play. The homicidal lunatics, rehearsing to be genocidal lunatics, of 9/11 were perhaps tempted by virgins, but it is far more revolting to contemplate that, like so many of their fellow jihadists, they were virgins. Like monks of old, the fanatics are taken early from their families, taught to despise their mothers and sisters, and come to adulthood without ever having had a normal conversation, let alone a normal relationship with a woman. This is disease by definition. Christianity is too repressed to offer sex in paradise. Indeed, it has never been able to evolve a tempting heaven at all. But it has been lavish in its promise of sadistic and everlasting punishment for sexual backsliders, which is nearly as revealing in making the same point in a different way. A special sub-genre of modern literature is the memoir of a man or woman who once underwent a religious education. The modern world is now sufficiently secular for some of these authors to attempt to be funny about what they underwent and what they were expected to believe. However, such books tend necessarily to be written by those with enough fortitude to have survived the experience. We have no way to quantify the damage done by telling tens of millions of children that masturbation will make them blind, or that impure thoughts will lead to an eternity of torment, or that members of other faiths, including members of their own families, will burn, or that venereal disease will result from kisses. Nor can we hope to quantify the damage done by holy instructors, who rammed home these lies, and accompanied them with floggings and rapes and public humiliations. Some of those who rest in unvisited tombs may have contributed to the good of the world, but those who preached hatred and fear and guilt, and who ruined innumerable childhoods, should have been thankful that the hell they preached was only one among their wicked falsifications, and that they were not sent to rot there. Violent, irrational, intolerant, allied to racism and tribalism and bigotry, invested in ignorance and hostile to free inquiry, contemptuous of women and coercive toward children, organized religion ought to have a great deal on its conscience. There is one more charge to be added to the bill of indictment. With a necessary part of its collective mind, religion looks forward to the destruction of the world. By this, I do not mean it looks forward in the purely eschatological sense of anticipating the end. I mean, rather, that it openly or covertly wishes that end to occur. Perhaps half aware that its unsupported arguments are not entirely persuasive, and perhaps uneasy about its own greedy accumulation of temporal power and wealth, religion has never ceased to proclaim the apocalypse and the day of judgment. This has been a constant trope ever since the first witch doctors and shamans learned to predict eclipses and to use their half-baked celestial knowledge to terrify the ignorant. It stretches from the epistles of St. Paul, who clearly thought and hoped that time was running out for humanity, through the deranged fantasies of the Book of Revelation, which were at least memorably written by the alleged St. John the Divine on the Greek island of Patmos, to the best-selling Pulp Fiction Left Behind series, which, ostensibly authored by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, was apparently generated by the old expedient of letting two orangutans loose on a word processor. The blood continued to rise. Millions of birds flocked into the area and feasted on the remains, and the wine press was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the wine press up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. This is sheer manic relish, larded with half quotations. More reflectively, but hardly less regrettably, it can be found in Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic, which dwells on the same wine press, and in Robert Oppenheimer's murmur as he watched the first nuclear detonation at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and heard himself quoting the Hindu epic, the Bhagavad Gita, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." One of the very many connections between religious belief and the sinister, spoiled, selfish childhood of our species is the repressed desire to see everything smashed up and ruined and brought to naught. This tantrum need is coupled with two other sorts of guilty joy, or, as the Germans say, Schadenfreude. First, one's own death is cancelled, or perhaps repaid or compensated, by the obliteration of all others. Second, it can always be egotistically hoped that one will be personally spared, gathered contentedly to the bosom of the mass exterminator, and from a safe place observe the sufferings of those less fortunate. Tertullian, one of the many church fathers who found it difficult to give a persuasive account of paradise, was perhaps clever in going for the lowest possible common denominator and promising that one of the most intense pleasures of the afterlife would be endless contemplation of the tortures of the damned. He spoke more truly than he knew in evoking the man-made character of faith. As in all cases, the findings of science are far more awe-inspiring than the rantings of the godly. The history of the cosmos begins, if we use the word time to mean anything at all, about 12 billion years ago. If we use the word time wrongly, we shall end up with the infantile computation of the celebrated Archbishop James Usher of Armagh, who calculated that the Earth alone, mind you, not the cosmos, had its birthday on Saturday, October 22nd, in 4004 BC, at 6 in the afternoon. This dating was endorsed by William Jennings Bryan, a former American Secretary of State and two-time Democratic presidential nominee, in courtroom testimony in the third decade of the 20th century. The true age of the sun and its orbiting planets, one of them destined to harbour life and all the others doomed to lifelessness, is perhaps 4.5 billion years and subject to revision. This particular microscopic solar system most probably has at least that long again to run its fiery course. The life expectancy of our sun is a solid 5 billion more years. However, mark your calendar, at around that point, it will emulate millions of other suns and explosively mutate into a swollen red giant, causing the Earth's oceans to boil and extinguishing all possibility of life in any form. No description by any prophet or visionary has even begun to picture the awful intensity and irrevocability of that moment. One has at least some pitiful self-centered reason not to fear undergoing it. On current projections, the biosphere will very probably have been destroyed by different and slower sorts of warming and heating in the meantime. As a species on Earth, according to many sanguine experts, we do not have many more eons ahead of us. With what contempt and suspicion, then, must one regard those who are not willing to wait, and who beguile themselves and terrify others, especially the children, as usual, with horrific visions of apocalypse, to be followed by stern judgment from the one who supposedly placed us in this inescapable dilemma to begin with? We may laugh now at the foam-flecked hell and damnation preachers, who love to shrivel young souls with pornographic depictions of eternal torture. But this phenomenon has reappeared in a more troubling form with the holy alliance between the believers and what they can borrow or steal from the world of science. Here is Professor Pervez Hoodboy, a distinguished professor of nuclear and high-energy physics at the University of Islamabad, Pakistan, writing about the frightening mentality which prevails in his country, one of the world's first states to define its very nationality by religion. In a public debate on the eve of the Pakistani nuclear tests, the former chief of the Pakistani army, General Mirza Aslam Beg, said, "We can make a first strike, and a second and even a third." The prospect of nuclear war left him unmoved. "You can die crossing the street," he said, "or you could die in a nuclear war. You've got to die some day anyway." India and Pakistan are largely traditional societies where the fundamental belief structure demands disempowerment and surrender to larger forces. A fatalistic Hindu belief that the stars above determine our destiny, or the equivalent Muslim belief in kismet, certainly account for part of the problem. I shall not disagree with the very brave Professor Hoodboy, who helped alert us to the fact that there were several secret bin Laden supporters among the bureaucrats of the Pakistani nuclear program, and who also exposed the wild fanatics within that system who hoped to harness the power of the mythical jinns or desert devils for military purposes. In his world, the enemies are mainly Muslims and Hindus. But within the Judeo-Christian world also, there are those who like to fantasize about a final conflict and embellish the vision with mushroom-shaped clouds. It is a tragic and potentially lethal irony that those who most despise science and the method of free inquiry should have been able to pilfer from it and annex its sophisticated products to their sick dreams. The death wish, or something not unlike it, may be secretly present in all of us. At the turn of the year 1999 into 2000, many educated people talked and published infinite nonsense about a series of possible calamities and dramas. This was no better than primitive numerology. In fact, it was slightly worse, in that 2000 was only a number on Christian calendars, and even the stoutest defenders of the Bible story now admit that if Jesus was ever born, it wasn't until at least AD 4. The occasion was nothing more than an odometer for idiots who sought the cheap thrill of impending doom. But religion makes such impulses legitimate and claims the right to officiate at the end of life, just as it hopes to monopolize children at life's beginning. There can be no doubt that the cult of death and the insistence upon portents of the end proceed from a surreptitious desire to see it happen and to put an end to the anxiety and doubt that always threaten the hold of faith. When the earthquake hits, or the tsunami inundates, or the twin towers ignite, you can see and hear the secret satisfaction of the faithful. Gleefully they strike up. "You see, this is what happens when you don't listen to us." With an unctuous smile, they offer a redemption that is not theirs to bestow, and when questioned, put on the menacing scowl that says, "Oh, so you reject our offer of paradise? Well, in that case, we have quite another fate in store for you." Such love, such care. The element of the wish for obliteration can be seen without disguise in the millennial sects of our own day, who betray their selfishness as well as their nihilism by announcing how many will be saved from the ultimate catastrophe. Here, the extreme Protestants are almost as much at fault as the most hysterical Muslims. In 1844, one of the greatest American religious revivals occurred, led by a semi-literate lunatic named George Miller. Mr. Miller managed to crowd the mountaintops of America with credulous fools who, having sold their belongings cheap, became persuaded that the world would end on October 22nd of that year. They removed themselves to high ground. What difference did they expect that to make? Or to the roofs of their hovels? When the ultimate failed to arrive, Miller's choice of terms was highly suggestive. It was, he announced, the great disappointment. In our own time, Mr. Hal Lindsey, author of the best-selling The Late Great Planet Earth, has betrayed the same thirst for extinction. Indulged by senior American conservatives and respectfully interviewed on TV, Mr. Lindsey once dated the start of The Tribulation, a 7-year period of strife and terror, for 1988. That would have produced Armageddon itself, the closure of The Tribulation, in 1995. Mr. Lindsey may be a charlatan, but it is a certainty that he and his followers suffer from a persistent feeling of anticlimax. Antibodies to fatalism and suicide and masochism do exist, however, and are just as innate in our species. There is a celebrated story from Puritan Massachusetts in the late 18th century. During a session of the state legislature, the sky suddenly became leaden and overcast at midday. Its threatening aspect, a darkness at noon, convinced many legislators that the event so much on their clouded minds was imminent. They asked to suspend business and to go home to die. The Speaker of the Assembly, Abraham Davenport, managed to keep his nerve and dignity. "Gentlemen," he said, "either the day of judgment is here, or it is not. If it is not, there is no occasion for alarm and lamentation. If it is, however, I wish to be found doing my duty. I move, therefore, that candles be brought. In his own limited and superstitious day, this was the best that Mr. Davenport could do. Nonetheless, I second his motion.